This is the third in a series of four meditations purporting, anyway, to offer straight answers to some of the questions that characterize our life together. It all started a month or so ago when our four-year-old asked a question about the relationship between God and Santa, and somehow I came up with a straight answer. Thought, well, let's try that with a few other things. And 3 weeks ago, we talked about the sacraments, a kind of theology lesson and what we do and why we baptize, commune, and confess. And the week after that, a kind of inspirational meditation on the history, meaning, and vitality of the Bible. So we have theology and inspiration. I guess last week was the halftime show. Today, more mundane in a way, but a straight answer about the church and its ministry. Kind of the nuts and bolts of what we do in the course of our day-by-day work as God's people in this place. Straight answers about the church and its ministry. Much more practical than theological or inspirational. Actually, it's a straight answer to a question. Does the church save souls? Answer, no. I'm going to get into salvation next week. But that's what the church is not about, and I want to tell you not only why, but what the church is about in light of that. There have been claims made throughout history, I suspect, that the church is sort of the carrier of salvation. We are the carrier of the story of salvation, but salvation comes from God alone. Maybe they got the idea from Martin Luther, who was fond of saying, "Be ye little Christs one unto another." It sort of implies a little Christ might save a soul or two. I had a theology professor who also taught homiletics, and before he went back to graduate school to be credentialed to do that, he was a very down-to-earth, plain-spoken, rural minister from Nebraska. And he took that quote from Luther and said, "Little Christs, what a relief. You don't have to be the big one." You know, sometimes we get so caught up in heavenly things that we become no earthly good. And I think the church and its ministry is about being earthly good during the time we have, which isn't all that much, so let's make good use of it. What is it that are the essentials of the church's ministry? Well, interestingly enough, this past week, I think we've got a little window on some of that, or at least a way of characterizing the essence of what the church is about in the here and now through the election of the new pope, Pope Francis I. And part of what went into discussions about how the Roman Catholic Church needed to be more relevant to its specific time and place and how that might be reflected in who was chosen to be pontiff was a lack of transparency to this point, especially a lack of transparency that led to a great deal of what we now know are horrific scandals with regard to leadership abuse. So part of what the Catholic Church said it wanted to do through the election of, it turns out, Francis I, is to be more transparent, to sort of open the doors a little bit, and in one sense, be more open and obvious, but also less frightening and obscure. Transparency. Kind of hard to be anything less than transparent in a small town, which is, I think fortunate in a way. I mean, our church is an example, you know, our books are open, and there's very little about what we do that isn't known to the people we interact with in the community. As it should be. There should be no secrets. Should be no secrets about the direction we wish to go, no secrets about problems that we wish to solve, and how we choose to solve them becomes a matter of negotiation. In one sense, it's kind of a relief to find transparency in a church or even in any of our relationships. I mean, another word for transparency is communication and intimacy. Talking to people who love us about things that bother us, things that give us joy, concerns that we have, even where we are and what we're about. Of course, there's modern technology that'll help us. I've actually got an app on my iPhone now. If I activate it, I can find out where Jeannie's iPhone is. Presumably, That's good news. And her with me. It's just an example of how a relationship and the transparency within it brings about trust and intimacy. The biblical basis for this, I think, as a part of the church's ministry, is Jesus cleansing the temple. He does this at the start of the week, the end of which he gets killed. This was not something that was welcomed in Jerusalem. He came to the temple and in a furious rage overturned the tables of the money changers, who were essentially loan sharks. And he revealed the underbelly of a corruption that he thought needed to be changed. So Jesus' cleansing of the temple is an effort at revealing both the need for and maybe even the process by which ministry becomes transparent. First little piece in the nature of the church's ministry, transparency through communication and intimacy. And of course, it almost goes without saying that there are no secrets between God and God's people. That's why we have prayer. Transparency through communication and prayer. Secondly, I think inclusiveness was on the table, certainly in the Sistine Chapel as the conclave proceeded. And the result, Cardinal Jorge Bergoglio of Argentina became Pope Francis I, the first Latin American pope. The plurality of the world's Catholic population coming now from Latin America, now represented in a more inclusive way by one of their own. Inclusiveness in the church, well, it's something of a work in progress. And sometimes we get it, sometimes we don't, sometimes we're late to the game. I was a young seminarian in 1978, and the denomination with which I was affiliated had ordained its first woman in 1971. Sort of late to the game. Presbyterians and Methodists had done so sometime prior to that. But there were only a few women in our seminary class, even 7 years later, some of the best and the brightest, as it turned out. And the notion of inclusiveness and the full experience and participation in ministry was still the subject of some debate, certainly among the faculty. We only had one woman on the faculty of the whole seminary, and that, it turned out, happened to be an unordained woman who taught Christian education. Well, of course, she was the Sunday school teacher. Nonetheless, a biblical story that we're less aware of than we might otherwise be. In the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 18, the author of Luke's Gospel also wrote the book of Acts, writes about a young, eager, new convert preacher going about Ephesus preaching about Jesus. But he's not fully aware of the whole story. His name is Apollos. Probably not heard of him. He's a relatively obscure character in the New Testament, going about Ephesus with a great deal of eagerness and energy, but he doesn't quite know the whole story. He's got the baptism of John and John the Baptist's preceding work to the presence of Jesus. Well, Paul hears about this, is impressed by his vigor and energy, his youth, and sends a couple of his own followers off to Ephesus to school him up, in effect creating the first theological seminary. Well, Paul's two followers are a husband and wife team. A husband and wife team. Priscilla and Aquila go to Ephesus, enroll Apollos in the first seminary, and school him up. So one of the first two professors of theology in the New Testament is a woman. And I bet you didn't know this. Priscilla is among the leading candidates when scholars speculate who might be the anonymous author of the Epistle to the Hebrews. Priscilla just might have written the book of Hebrews. There's better evidence for her than just about anybody else. So we have a very powerful image of inclusiveness in the New Testament, calling to question the extent to which our ministry can be even more inclusive. Transparency, inclusiveness lead to what I think is the most important thing any church can do, and that is to empower, to be a source of empowerment to those who are without it, And I think Cardinal Bergoglio becoming Francis I illustrates in part his effort to do this. St. Francis of Assisi was a wealthy man who renounced his wealth and spent his entire life working for, with, and on behalf of the poor. Cardinal Bergoglio in Argentina was a strong advocate for ministry to and with, among others, people with AIDS. He is, by all accounts, a simple and straightforward man. Rode the bus to work in Argentina, carries his own luggage, and so on, as an effort toward empowerment. Well, how's that worked for us in the course of church history? Well, I think in the 50s, a lot of us did a pretty good job of, among other things, walking kids to the schoolhouse doors in the context of bringing about the struggle for civil rights. On the other hand, Lutheran history, at least, has an example that unfortunately has been repeated in various ways and to perhaps lesser degrees. In 1524, there was a peasants' revolt in Germany, about the same time the Protestant Reformation is getting cranked up. Terrible injustices with regard to peasant population, peasant labor, the whole economy of the time. And an uprising occurred, which was squashed by the German aristocracy, in the course of which Martin Luther himself wrote a treatise against the thieving, murderous hordes of peasants. Not our finest hour. On the other hand, the church has been at least on the forefront or even late to the game involved in empowering others. The biblical reference for this, I think, is the story of the 10 lepers. Jesus cures 10 lepers and 9 run their way and 1 comes back to say thank you. And we sort of reduce the meaning of that story by using it as the text typically on Thanksgiving to sort of guilt us all into thinking we should be more grateful, like the one that came back. That misses the point entirely. 10 lepers are cured of a disease that kept them not only from interacting with others because they were ill, but kept them from having any status in society at all. Leprosy made them outcast. It made them unclean. It made them untouchable in every way imaginable. Jesus cures their affliction, but then says, and this is the point, go show yourselves to the priests. Because the priests were the gatekeepers of citizenship, of dignity, of the reality of life that was legitimate. Jesus sent these cured lepers to show themselves to the priests so the priests could legitimate and re-empower them and empower them. Well, anybody on that list today that could use the empowering of the church? A little bit controversial. Gay marriage was in the news again this week. Senator Portman from Ohio, a Republican, a conservative Republican, withdrew his opposition to gay marriage in part because it turns out his son is gay. And the world apparently didn't end in their family. Well, we're in the marriage business. That's what we do. We believe in monogamy. We believe that marriage strengthens the love that two people have for one another. 9 states in the U.S. have agreed, including the District of Columbia. We're sort of late to the game on raising this question, and it remains contentious. I think we are called to be empowerers of those. Of those who, like anyone who wishes to express and legitimate their love, can do so in the church. Transparency, prayer, intimacy, communication, inclusiveness. Who belongs? Who would Jesus invite? Who would Jesus exclude? Can't think of anybody. Who could use a boost from the energy we have as an institution in our world? Transparency, inclusiveness, empowerment, TIE. You want to hold a soundbite from today's meditation? What did he have to say about the church? Tie, as in blessed be the tie that binds us as one, that binds us as one in faith, blessed beyond our wildest imagination, with forgiveness, love, and grace, and called simply to be instruments of his peace through openness, inclusiveness, and empowerment. Blessed be the tie that binds us. Amen.